Accession number 4583, Reel 2.
Wing Commander Helm, Reel 2. Could you describe what the training at number 4 Flying Training School consisted of?
Well, yes, we moved on from the ab initio type of aircraft, the Tiger Moth, to service aircraft. That was the Hart and the Audax, which were the two main training aircraft at that time. The Hart was a it was a fighter. Originally it was a Hawker fighter, but it was set up for dual control, whereas the Audax was a single-seater, again, fighter. And we started off by going through exactly the same type of flying that we had done in our elementary work with the Tiger Moth, spinning, aerobatics, turns, deep turns, climbing, gliding, and so on. And this was done every day, but once again under service instructors this time, and service flying.
How did that compare with the previous type of instructor?
Well, it was virtually the same. There was very little difference. My instructor at the elementary school had been a flying officer, Richards, whereas my instructor at 4FTS was a flight sergeant, Jeffrey. An excellent man, actually.
What was the Hart like to fly?
It was a very good aircraft. I found no faults with it, but I had one fault in particular in my flying, which was noted in my logbook, that I tended to get slow when coming into land. It's always been a failing of mine. Why, I don't know, don't ask me. There is a landing speed laid down, but I nearly always dropped below the set speed and consequently was very near the stall point all the time I was coming into land. But I overcame it.
If you had stalled, what would have happened?
Well, I would have gone in. Because coming with an aircraft, there is a landing speed. I forget what it was in the Hart, but say for argument's sake it was 60 miles an hour. Well, I tended to drop below the 60 miles an hour, and when you're coming in at that angle, when you get too slow, you stall, your nose drops, your wing tilts, and you're in. So I would have written myself off very quickly.
Were there any problems with the Hart?
No, not at all. We got on with them very well. In fact, we took to the Hart and Audax extremely well. I found no problems with them at all.
Were there any main differences flying the Audax as compared with the Hart?
No, they were both very similar in every respect. It's just that the Audax carried a rear gunner behind the pilot, was set up as a fighter, a single engine fighter, but it did carry a rear gunner. Within the Hart, the rear gunner's position was taken by the other pilot, so it could carry two pilots. So all dual instruction was carried out on the Hart.
How much instruction a week would you get?
Oh, I would say about 11 hours a week.
Was that adequate?
Yes, it was quite adequate to go through the course. The junior course up to obtaining your wings was 3 months. At the end of 3 months, you then had a qualifying wings examination, which again was the ground subjects plus your flying ability and completion of so many hours on type.
What did the ground subjects consist of in those?
Well, the same thing: navigation, meteorology, airframes, engines, signals. The normal ground subjects that go with aviation in particular. I don't think they've ever changed. Exactly the same.
Was all the instruction done in the mornings, or did you work in the afternoon?
No, we actually, in the Middle East, all flying and ground instruction was carried out in the morning. We only worked in the morning. We did not work in the afternoon. We actually started about 7 o'clock in the morning and worked through until 2 o'clock in the afternoon. Then we stopped. The whole station stopped, and you were entirely left to your own devices.
And how did you spend your free time?
Well, playing squash, sport in particular. There were drills, of course, that sort of thing. But there wasn't very much to do, I must admit, at Aberystwyth. It was rather isolated. It was away from... well, Moesca, Ismailia, was our nearest town, which was a taxi ride away. Say approximately about 7 miles. And that was the only town of any size within the area. So if we wanted to go shopping or we wanted to go into town, we had to go to Ismailia.
Did you get bored?
To a certain extent, sometimes, yes. It was all a new experience when we got out there. I mean, I think everybody on the course bought cameras, and photography took up a certain amount of time, but I think we lacked company more than anything else. There were no women, of course, except the wives of senior officers on the station, flight commanders and COs of squadrons and that sort of thing. There was the French club in Ismailia. That was the French pilots' club, not air pilots, navigation pilots for the Suez Canal. They had a club in Ismailia, which was very good, of which we were all members. And, of course, there was the Armed Forces Club, sailing club in Ismailia as well. That was quite useful. They had yachts, dinghy yachts in Bordeaux, and we were able to go down there and get a meal, and you could use the club facilities. There was something to do all the time.
Did you have the opportunity to get out and see the sights of Egypt?
Well, we did when we got leave, which was not too frequent. When we got leave, most of us made for Cairo, which of course none of us had been to before. When we got to Cairo, we did all the sights. We went to see the pyramids and the Sphinx and toured Cairo itself. That did give us some relaxation and an interest. But of course, leaves didn't last very long. They were 7 days at a time.
As you moved about outside the cantonment, how did you get on with the Egyptian civilian population?
Well, perfectly all right. Of course, Egypt in those days was under British military rule. And I can't say that I ever came across an incident where I ran into any trouble with an Egyptian civilian or Egyptians.
What was their manner towards you on the street?
Oh, quite all right. We belonged to the Gezira Club, which, of course, is the sports club in the Middle East. And we played golf there, we swam there. And I met many Egyptians, but they all seemed to be perfectly all right.
What type of Egyptians did you meet?
Middle-class ones, I would say.
And on the aerodrome itself, were there Egyptians working there?
Yes, most of the menial labour was undertaken by Egyptian workers. They were mess servants, personal servants. We had batmen that were Egyptians. Each officer had a room to himself in the area we were in, and the batmen was responsible for looking after cleanliness and uniforms and so on and so forth. Normal batman's duties. Some of them had been there for years.
Was their work satisfactory?
Oh, yes. No problems at all. At least I had no problems with them.
Coming back to the work that you were doing at Aberystwyth, could you tell me if the flying conditions in Egypt were different in any way to those in England?
Oh, very different. Firstly, the weather was quite predictable, where it's not in this country. Most days were quite sunny, fine. Occasional sand rising, which we didn't, when that happened, we didn't fly. Most of our flying was done away from the airport proper. There were advanced landing fields out in the desert, and we were taken out there by truck, or we went by aircraft with our instructors and landed at these advanced flying grounds and operated from there.
Were there any problems with flying in Egypt that you wouldn't have in the UK?
No, not really. I found it highly delightful because flying was so easy compared to this country.
Wasn't there more problem with convection currents there?
No. Convection currents didn't bother us anyway. Being a powered aircraft, we always had control of the aircraft, convection currents or no.
What about navigation? Was that more of a problem?
Well, navigation was a problem because everything looked the same. You virtually navigated in those days by the seat of your pants anyway. Picked out the nearest railway line, and you knew where the railway line went to, and you followed the railway line, or the road, or the oil pipeline, whatever it was.
Were there any instances of pilots getting lost?
Not from our point of view, no. We had a very good record.
What were the instruments like for navigation in those days?
Just the same as they are now. There's no difference between Concorde and a flying moth, or a Tiger moth. Blind flying panel is exactly the same.
You said that the short N course in the... You mentioned the short N course in the Middle
yes.
East. What do you mean by the N course?
Well, that's what is known as a short navigation course. It's a 3 months navigation course, purely designed for a pilot navigator. And if you pass the course, you're entitled to put a symbol N next to your name and rank. They started this, we were the guinea pigs on our course, when we passed out into advanced flying training, which involved air gunnery, bombing, so on and so forth, war climbs with the aircraft. We thought that when we finished it, we'd be going to squadrons. Unfortunately, Middle East introduced this short end course, and our particular course was the first one to go on it, which meant we had to stay at Abuswera a further 3 months to complete the course, which I didn't pass, I must admit.
So what happened when you didn't pass?
Well, nothing. I just still went to a squadron.
So you didn't have to retake?
No. No, there were no retakes. And it didn't really mean anything. It probably did to your service career in the long run, yes. Although, as it turned out, with the war which came along, didn't really make very much difference.
You mentioned bombing practice. How accurate could bombing be in those days?
Well, it could be pretty accurate. They used the 11.5-pound practice bombs and used a heart for actually doing the bombing. You carried another pilot with you who was acting as a bomb aimer. He had to find the wind and use that wind on his bomb sight and then bomb the target. Some people got down to no more than 6 foot distance between the target and the bomb. But it was all rather a bit of a hit and a miss affair anyway. The bomb sights were not of the best.
What was the problem with the bomb sights?
Well, they were not up to date. We were using triangular winds, which the bomb aimer had to find while he was flying. And then he had to put that wind that he'd found on the bomb sight and then calculate from his bomb sight exactly what effect that wind was going to have on the bombs that he was dropping. It was a long, rather tedious process. But we were nevertheless tested in bombing and gunnery. We had to use the front gun on ground targets and on drogues that were towed by their aircraft. But I say it was a bit of a hit and a miss affair, because at the time I was hospitalised with dengue fever, and I was got up out of bed and put into an aircraft and sent up to do a bombery, a bombing mission, which they were assessing my assessment for my licence. And I didn't get the wind right, and I dropped a salvo of bombs anyway. In fact, I dropped all my bombs in one go, whereas I should have dropped them one at a time. But I got a below average for that.
How difficult was it to hit the drogue?
Well, it was bloody difficult, because I don't think the instructors that were... they were teaching you how to do quarter beam attacks. In other words, coming in from behind the aircraft, turning right into the drogue and firing at the drogue when you've got it in your sights. The idea being that you shouldn't get the gun pointing at the towing aircraft at any time in the manoeuvre. Well, my instructor hadn't told me exactly how he wanted it done, so I came blasting in and turned straight across the towing aircraft, straight onto the drogue, and fired, which of course put him in jeopardy. So I got a red and had to break it off.
How did you communicate with the ground?
We didn't. There were ground panels, that was all. There was no such thing in the Middle East in those days of radio telephony. We didn't have anything.
What did the panels consist of?
Well, if they wanted to put a signal panel out, they could put a marker on the ground, which meant something to the pilot in the air.
Can you give some examples?
Well, they do in air flying control. They have a signals panel in front of every control tower, and that has various signals in it. Dumbbells, a red panel with a diagonal stripe across it, all of which means something. The dumbbells means that it's landing on runways only. And the circuit, of course, is a left-hand circuit. And this is indicated by an arrow going round a red panel to the left. And, of course, there's the wind sock, as you know, which tells you the direction of the surface wind. So you're entirely on your own when you are flying to an airfield that you didn't know. You had to read these signals from the signals square before you attempted a landing.
Could you see the signals?
Oh, you could see the signals. There was no bother about that, yes.
It was just the limitation.
It was just the limitation. You could get no other information from anybody. You were just strictly on your own.
Was there any means of communicating between one aircraft and another?
No, they were all hand signals. Particularly when we got on to formation flying, which we did. These signals were given by the leader of the formation in his own aircraft with the hand, which told you whether he was going to make a right turn and when he wanted you to start making the right turn, when he was going into land and so on and so forth. You had, obviously, in formation flying, you had to keep your eyes very closely on the aircraft right next to you and the leader of the formation, so that you knew exactly what was going on the whole time.
What about the manoeuvrability of the aircraft in those days?
Oh, there's nothing wrong with the manoeuvrability of the aircraft. The Hawker Hart and the Hawker Audax were, of course, the forerunner of the Hawker Hurricane. And, well, you know as well as I do what the Hawker Hurricane could do during the Battle of Britain. Well, the Audax and the Hart were just as manoeuvrable, but of course, obviously, not so fast.
Were there any accidents at the time at Abu Suir whilst you were there?
Yes, there were. It was an accident at night. I've got a picture of it, actually. It was one of our senior term who was coming into land who overshot and crashed the aircraft off the runway on its nose, and was hospitalised and had to join our course. He was put off his own course because of injuries received. He didn't die.
What type of lighting arrangements were there for night landing?
Glim lamps.
What were they?
Well, glim lamp was just an ordinary light with a battery in it, rather similar to the ones that you can buy now in caravans, where you can switch it on underneath, and it produced a white light shining upwards, and you put out a flare path with the glim lamps, and also gooseneck flares.
What were they?
Well, they were just ordinary kerosene flares, rather in the form of a... probably difficult to describe, a cylinder with a funnel on it, rather like a big teapot. From the end of the funnel protruded a wick, and the rest of the cylinder was filled with kerosene, and you could light the wick and they just burned. But those were the only lights we ever had for night flying.
How effective were these arrangements?
Oh, you could see them perfectly all right. There was no bother. I mean, any light that you see on the ground can easily be identified without problem.
If a pilot had an accident, what would be the consequences for him, apart from, of course, any injury that happened to him?
Well, there'd be a court of inquiry, and resulting from the findings of the court of inquiry, he could be grounded, he could be taken off flying, dependent on what the verdict was, whether it was pilot error or that it wasn't, what really contributed to the accident.
Was there a court of inquiry for every accident, then?
Oh, yes. There always is. Service carries out its own court of inquiry for any accident that occurs.
After you'd been at Abu Sweer, in 1939, you were transferred to Transjordan.
Well, yes, I was posted from the training school at on the completion of the course and was posted to 14 Squadron in Amman. It was up in Jordan. They were flying Worldsleys.
Were you pleased when you heard that you were going there?
Yes, I had applied for 14 Squadron, actually.
Why had you applied for it?
Couldn't really give any reason. One, that they were flying Worldsleys, which was, of course, the forerunner of the Wellington. It was designed by Barnes Wallis. It's the first geodetic construction aircraft that came into being in the services. It was fully hydraulically operated. It was a pleasure to fly. And
why was it a pleasure to fly?
Well, because everything was hydraulically operated or electrically operated, and everything was in fingertip control. The flaps were all operated by hydraulics. Just had one lever, small switch. Push it up or push it down, your flaps went down or up. You didn't have any winding to do or anything like that.
Was it the attraction of flying the Wellesley that made you apply to go to 14
Squadron? No, 14 Squadron were actually on operations at the time. They were on an active service footing even before the war started because of the Palestine Rebellion, which was in full swing at that time.
Were you involved in these operations yourself?
No, I was involved in as much that I had to go through Palestine to get to Jordan, and en route going up from Lydda from Kantara in Egypt, the train was blown up, the line was blown up. I was a passenger on the train.
Can you describe what happened?
Well, at that time the Palestine police, of course, were very much in the forefront of the trouble in Palestine, and all trains were targets, as they always are, and they had a trolley which went in advance of the train over the line, supposedly to set off any bomb that was on the line before the train actually reached it. And we just crossed the border into Palestine, and they set off a bomb which blew up the railway line just in front of the train. It was a 500-pound bomb, which the main charge didn't go off. It was a small charge next to the bomb, which should have ignited the bomb so that the whole thing went up. But unfortunately, or fortunately, as the case happened, it only set off the subsidiary charge. It didn't set off the main charge. So, of course, we were halted on the railway until they got the line repaired.
Were any of the carriages derailed?
No. The train was able to stop, you see, before it got to the point of the explosion, because the trolley in front had set the charge off well before the train got to it. But I always remember we stopped opposite an abandoned railway station, which was pockmarked with bullets and had been set on fire. Obviously, being quite a skirmish there at some time prior to our arrival.
Did you travel armed?
Yes.
What with?
38 revolver. We travelled armed. Well, all officers had to wear sidearms anyway.
Did you feel apprehensive travelling
nope.
through Palestine?
No more apprehensive than I had felt anywhere else. It didn't really mean that much to us. Don't forget, I was quite young and fairly well inexperienced of what went on in the world. And it didn't really bother me. We stayed in the King David Hotel in Jerusalem. That was before it was blown up. Overnight before we went on up into Jordan, we had to go into Jordan by ground in a 2-ton lorry, because there were no rail facilities going up into Jordan. So we went from Jerusalem by lorry in a ground convoy, which was protected by one of 14 squadron aircraft flying overhead of the convoy in case of ground attack, and went right through the Dead Sea and then climbed up into the mountains and finally reached Amman.
What were your impressions of Amman when you got there?
Oh, not very good. It was more desolate, if you like to put it that way, than number 4 FTS was. It was quite isolated. There were still the traces of the Roman occupation there, in very good condition, I may add. They had a miniature amphitheatre, which is still there today, of course. And they had part of a Roman fort not very far from Amman, on the top of a hill where part of the roadway was still existing. And I know I went up there sightseeing, and it was one of the finest examples I've seen of a Roman road. It was constructed in such a way that the water, when it rained, ran off down the sides into a drainage ditch beneath the surface of the road.
And what about the aerodrome of 14 Squadron?
Well, the aerodrome was on top of an escarpment about 1,500 feet up. And at the bottom of the escarpment was Glub Pasha's Arab Legion headquarters. Glub Pasha, of course, was a force to be reckoned with in Jordan in those days. And he had a fort, which was right below Amman. Amman was up here, and he was down there. And all our squadron took off from the runways and went straight over the top. If your engine failed or anything like that, you just went over the top of it and straight down into the valley below.
Did that ever happen?
It did, in actual fact. Quite an amusing story. A visiting pilot brought a Gordon up there and came into land, and he overshot and disappeared over the edge of the cliff, and obviously straight down, as everybody thought. Everybody from the station turned out to go and find the wreckage and look for him. Couldn't find anything at all. When they came back a couple of hours later, he was sitting in the mess having a drink. What had happened was his engine had failed. He'd gone over the top, and because of the 1,500-foot drop, he'd been able to restart his engine and flown up the wadi, come round and landed while everybody was disappearing down to find him. So it did have its amusing side.